Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. Consider the origins of some of the companies that you probably rely on the most, Amazon or Apple or Google. What do their stories have in common? Well, they were all founded in garages.
The founders of these companies, Steve Jobs, Jeff Bezos, Larry Page, are considered visionaries who started these companies with a stroke of genius. Then, aha, there was the iPad or the Kindle. They were born suddenly.
But those aha moments are rare, according to our next guest. She says most inventions are collaborative and rely on a foundation of work done by many others, which is why protecting intellectual property can be so tricky.
Whether you realize it or not, you're probably interacting with intellectual property law every day, even when you do something as simple as wishing someone happy birthday, like the cast of DGS tried to do on the NBC show 30 Rock.
Did you know that if you sing happy birthday on a TV show, you have to pay for it?
I did not know that.
Hey!
Jessica Silby is a professor of law at Suffolk University, and she's author of The Eureka Myth, Creators, Innovators, and Everyday Intellectual Property. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And listeners, first, we want to tell you, we do want to hear from you. What is your reaction when you get, say, a copyright warning on a YouTube video? Should movies, music, or smartphone apps be freed from the chains of intellectual property law? Do you think the law needs to be loosened in the 21st century, or does it need to be expanded? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Jessica, I'm wondering if you could start the conversation by giving us a simple example of intellectual property law and how it might affect something that many of us might use every day.
Sure. So if we take a video of our children in our living room, for example, and there's music playing in the background, and then we post it to Facebook or to YouTube, that music in the background might be subject to copyright that we might be infringing by posting online.
So we're doing something illegal.
We would be, yes.
And what's the penalty for something like that?
Well, the statutory damages range from $750 per infringing act to $150,000 per infringing act.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. And many of us don't know that.
No, many of us don't know intellectual property law at all.
Right. So is it just not enforced? I mean, is this something that's on the books that nobody really pays attention to? Or what you know?
Well, more and more intellectual property law is being enforced because it's easily findable because we do so much more in digital medium. So when we share online, those things are traceable. They have digital fingerprints and we can be found. 25, 30 years ago when sharing happened with paper, it was harder to enforce and people thought maybe the harms were less likely.
Right. But now, of course, we do hear the isolated story of folks certainly getting caught doing something that many of us take for granted and don't even know that we're not supposed to be doing.
Right. Forwarding an email with an attachment to it, for example.
Right. And, of course, you know, most recently there was a terrific example of copyright law and in the movie Selma.
Right.
About the 1965 Selma voting rights marches led by Martin Luther King Jr. Right. All of King's speeches in the film had to be paraphrased. And we have a clip of an example of one. Let's listen to that.
The president doesn't want us to march today. The courts don't want us to march. But we must march. We must stand up. We must make a massive demonstration of our moral certainty. I'm so glad we're here together today. I thank you for standing up. For we shall be victorious in our quest. We shall cross the finish line hand in hand. For we shall overcome.
So that, of course, a speech from the movie Selma, but that was paraphrasing what Martin Luther King Jr. actually said. Now, Jessica, why did that speech have to be paraphrased? What exactly was it about the law that said that they couldn't use the actual King speech?
Right. Well, so Martin Luther King wrote his speeches down. That's his creative expression that's subject to copyright protection. And he descended that property to his heirs, and his heirs own and control that property today. So they can license it to whomever they want, and they can choose not to license it. Apparently, they've licensed it to a different film company. And so when this film was being made, there was some dispute about whether they could also get it. And they decided instead to work around the copyright. And to paraphrase, copyright law is not supposed to be to prevent the distribution of material. It's supposed to incentivize the distribution of material. So it is unfortunate that when literary estates withhold historic material like this or any material and prevent the continuing conversation and critique and learning of history through it.
So how do you think that the law should be changed to make sure that creators are protected and that information can be disseminated so people can enjoy it and use it fairly?
Well, you started with the Happy Birthday dispute. That song originates from 1893, and one of the easiest targets for copyright reform today is the length of copyright. Copyright lasts for the life of the author plus 70 years, and if you're a corporation, 95 years, or 120, depending on creation or publication. And people just think that's too long. We don't need that kind of length in order to incentivize production and dissemination. So we could shorten the length, for example. We could require registration and notice on our copyrights. If you want to assert your copyright, you could provide notice on it. So all the stuff that gets shared online that could be or could not be subject to copyright could be free unless you claim it. That would be another easy way. We could reduce statutory damages. That would be another easy way. So the risk of infringement isn't so great.
Okay. We have lots of folks calling who want to weigh in on this. Again, listeners, we'd like to know your thoughts about copyright law and about intellectual property law, I guess, specifically, and how you think it should be either loosened or maybe broadened, or what you think, how you think it affects you. Our number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. William is calling from Northborough. William, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just wanting to talk about how I've been working in the 3D printing industry. That's really grown over the last few years, and it's all a result of the expiration of some key patents around the technology. And it's really grown and developed in sort of the hobby level, providing more accessibility and really cheaper and better 3D printers for a lot of people. And that really wouldn't be happening were it not for the sort of open source movement that's grown up around it.
Okay, so essentially you're saying 3D printing has been able to improve because some of the laws essentially have expired?
Yes, the patents around the technology expired, and also that the people who are working on it in the open source movement are not really being restrictive about who controls the ideas and technology, and that's been really helpful.
Jessica Silby, are you familiar with
this? Of course, yeah. 3D printing is an excellent example of our 21st century copy machine, where we are really excited about the capabilities that 3D printing enables. I was learning just the other day that surgeons at local hospitals print bones and different parts of the body in order to practice doing surgery on them, and 3D printers enable that kind of wonderful innovation for our health and science. If patents did not expire or people were not more generous with the patents than the laws otherwise provide, these kind of innovations would not occur. The fact that we have to rely on an expiration date, patents expire after 20 years, that's very different from for copyright, for example, or the generosity of patent holders is a problem for our innovation policy. For sure. So I appreciate William's question.
Hmm. You know, in your book, you include interviews with many people, some of whom have had their work protected, artists and other creative folks. And you actually start some of the book with an interview with a painter. Mm-hmm. And she compares her paintings to a litter of puppies and says she wants to find a good home. home for each of them. So are you saying essentially that the folks who create a lot of this stuff, they're not really interested per se in owning it forever, if you will? They are interested in disseminating it, and we're just not going about it, at least legally, the right way.
Right. A lot of the things that people care about who do the creation and innovation from the ground up are not the things that the law necessarily protects, like attribution, for example. The quote that you mentioned is all about affection and belonging, and a lot of people talk about why they create things and how they create them as in familial terms, the way we talk about families and relationships. Intellectual property is a property regime. It's about alienating your work so that it can be sold and disseminated. And sometimes that market-based structure really is a misalignment with the things that creators and innovators care deeply about.
Hmm. We have another phone caller here. Derek from Stoughton is on the air. Derek.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering more about the international and global impact of intellectual property, especially in this globalized society in a digital age where content is available to people all over the world. What are other countries doing to protect their content providers, and what's happening here in the United States with, you know, content originating here that might be, you know, getting out there in other countries?
Okay, Jessica. You want to
take so,
that?
Yeah, so intellectual property is a national regime, and different nations all over the world have different regimes. And so one dispute right now, for example, is with our pharmaceutical industry. India has different patent regime than the United States. So if our branded drugs get to India, for example, they are not as protected as they are in the United States. And so the anxiety is that it will get leaky and it will be sold for cheap or for copy. We have to care about whether or not we're creating these things to progress science the way the Constitution talks about nationally and globally, or whether we're doing it to make a lot of money. And I think that's a major choice that our innovation policy has to engage in.
And can the law reflect that enough, do you think? Can the law be written to make sure that we strike the right balance in that?
Well, Congress is striking balances regularly as between costs and benefits between these things. I think it's definitely a debate we have to have. What most important is that the debate be balanced. Most of the time when intellectual property policy is drafted, there are very few people at the table. Historically, in copyright debates and patent debates, it has been an expert body rather than a balanced body as between different interest groups. I think more and more we're seeing there's more balance now in the regime.
One thing that was interesting that you pointed out in the book was when you talked about the financial implications of all of this and corporations' role. Who owns what when someone creates it, and is it all about the money per se? And we have an interesting comment on Facebook. Kathleen Lambert comments on Facebook and says media should be protected by international or intellectual property laws, but the endless extensions of copyright have gone too far and benefit large corporations more than individual authors. I honestly think the prior law, if renewed, was reasonable. At some point, if a work is still around for a long time, it's part of our cultural tradition and should be treated as such. Your comments, Jessica.
Yeah, the old renewal system that she's talking about was very effective. So after the first Copyright Act was only 14 years, and if you wanted to renew your copyright after 14 years, you could renew it for another 14. And what that does is refresh your claim on it or put it into the public domain. Now that just doesn't happen. That kind of refreshment or require for registration would make a lot of sense today, I think, to enrich the public domain and clear out the thicket of all the intellectual properties that are out there holding things up.
And what about, is it all about the money?
People will say that you must have corporate entities in order to aggregate and disseminate effectively. I think one of the big problems is when people feel so distant from the work that they engage in, whether it's in a company, as a scientist or as an artist. The misalignment leads to disaffection, and I think it's a problem when people do not have some control over how their organizations in which they work every day use and make money off their work. I think that is a problem, and people will say that it is.
Very briefly, Jessica, do you think we'll see this changing anytime soon? I mean, you said Congress is debating this. I mean, do you think we'll see at least incremental changes?
I do think that in the past couple of years, we've seen significant pushback against copyright reform, international copyright reform, And with the new net neutrality debates, we're seeing the same kind of pushback. So I do think people are becoming more aware of how this affects everyday individuals. So, yes, I do think we are going to see some kind of copyright and patent reform.
All right. Jessica Silby, professor of law at Suffolk University Law School. Her new book is The Eureka Myth, Creators, Innovators, and Everyday Intellectual Property. Thanks very much for being with us.
I loved it. Thanks.
And stay with us. Coming up, historian Eric Foner's new insights on the Underground Railroad, where Boston and New Bedford played big roles. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.